let's go ahead and get started today on slide number one. So if you haven't already done so, please click on the Go to Training button to log in and take you to the first slide. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, it's my pleasure to welcome all of you to today's training course focused on guidance for characterization, design, construction, and monitoring of mitigation wetlands. My name is Mary Yalkin. I am coming to you from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I will be serving as your moderator today. Like all of our ITRC training courses, we do partner with EPA to offer our courses through their CLUIN website. So we partner with EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation and are pleased to have that continued relationship with EPA. As I mentioned, today's training course is focused on mitigation wetlands. And the goal for the course and also the associated guidance document that's listed on slide number one is to improve the success of wetland mitigation projects. This training presents comprehensive guidance for regulators, environmental professionals, or owners to understand, characterize, and design, as well as construct and monitor mitigation wetlands. And it is based off that technical and regulatory guidance document that was developed by ITRC's mitigation wetlands team. You will have an opportunity to download that guidance document if you haven't already done so at the conclusion of today's training course, as well as the training slides. And in those slides, there are some additional speaker's notes you cannot see on your screen if you're on the site live today. So if you haven't already downloaded those resources, we will encourage you to do so in the links page. Also in the links page, we will take you to at the conclusion of the training. You will have an opportunity to access several links that are pertinent to this topic. Certainly within the 2 hours we have today, we will be able to share with you a lot of information, but it's really that guidance document that will provide you more in-depth information on the subject as well as those other links. Also at the end of today's training, you will have an opportunity to give us some feedback on how the training went for you today. Now we're picking up a little bit of background noise from someone's phone, so if you have just joined us, we would ask that you please put your phone on mute, and again, if you don't have a mute function on your phone, please press *6 to mute your phone, and then *7 will remove that function from your phone. Now, each of you will be in control of your slides as we move through the training presentation today, and you'll see that there's a series of orange buttons at the top of each slide. The single arrow to the right will advance you one slide forward. The single arrow to the left will take you one slide back. The double arrows will take you either to the beginning or ending of the presentation, and the home symbol will return you to the page that had the presentation overview and pictures and bios of the instructors. Now, the question mark button is primarily for our simulcast users. Those are our participants today hearing the audio through their computer speakers, but can be used by anyone at any time during today's training course. If you click on that button, a screen will come up allowing you to type in your question. Once you press submit, that will come to me as the moderator. And then during the two designated question and answer periods, you will hear me verbally ask your question, and you will hear the instructor's verbal response. Certainly for those of you on the phone lines today, you will have a chance to ask your questions verbally. The computer disk symbol will allow you to download a copy of today's presentation, but because it's a fairly large file, I'd suggest you wait and do that until we get to the links page. On the left-hand side of your screen, you will see the slide numbers listed individually, and that can be handy if you want to ask a question about a specific slide during the question and answer periods. So let's go ahead and move on to slide number two by clicking on the single arrow to the right. And although many of you are frequent participants of ITRC training courses, we constantly have new people joining us, so a special welcome to all of you if this is your first ITRC training event. And just a few words about ITRC. ITRC is a state-led organization working in conjunction with the broader environmental community to develop tools and resources to help people make better decisions about the use of innovative approaches and technologies. We are hosted by the Environmental Council of States, and you can see our state membership by the states colored in green on the map. We are pleased to say that Wyoming just recently joined ITRC as our newest state member. For a state to be a member of ITRC, they must designate a state point of contact within their environmental or equivalent agency. We continue to enjoy the partnership of Department of Energy, Department of Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. And we not only work with these governmental agencies, but we also work with a broader network of industry, consultants, and academia, also community stakeholders and tribal representatives. These groups come together to work on technical teams, in this case the mitigation wetlands team that was hosted by ITRC, to develop tools and resources such as the training you're participating on today. So if you'd like more information about how you can get involved in ITRC, you can check out the ITRC website. Let's move now to slide number three, And this lists the courses we are offering in 2005. If you'd like more information on those courses, again, you can access the ITRC website. We also have archives of previously offered courses that you can access at your convenience and listen to those online. We also have podcasts available for several of those courses as well. Let's move on to the next slide, slide number four. For those of you that have just joined us, please review the logistical reminders on the right-hand side of the screen. Course time for this course is about 2.25 hours. On the left-hand side, you can see a brief presentation overview. We will start out with some of the basics of mitigation wetlands, so we make sure everybody has a common understanding of the definitions we are using and talk about some of the different types of wetlands, how you characterize the site, and then get into some of the design and monitoring considerations. As I mentioned before, we will have that break for questions and answers about halfway through and then again at the end. Moving to slide number five, I would like to introduce our instructors for today. We're very pleased to have these two gentlemen serve as ITRC volunteer instructors, and they have both been members of the ITRC Mitigation Wetlands team. First, we will be hearing from Paul Eager. He comes to us from St. Paul, Minnesota, where he is a principal engineer for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources in their Division of Lands and Minerals. He has over 25 years of experience where he has worked with environmental issues related to mining. He was a pioneer in the use of wetlands to remove trace metals for mine drainage, and much of his work is focused on the development of successful passive treatment systems to control mine drainage. We will then hear from Charles Harmon. He is a principal ecologist with AMIC Earth and Environmental, located in Somerset, New Jersey. He has over 16 years of experience in the environmental consulting field, and he specializes in natural resource-related assessment and management activities, including wetlands management and ecological restorations, ecological risk assessments, as well as natural resource damages. So it's my pleasure then on slide number six to turn it over to Mr. Paul Eager with the state of Minnesota. Paul?
Thanks, Mary. Well, number six is again just kind of a brief summary of what we're going to try to cover this afternoon. And as Mary mentioned, there's a lot more information in the guidance document. But these are the general areas that we'll at least try to touch on. Talk a little bit about, you know, what is wetlands mitigation. Again, some general review of wetland science, which I'm sure most of you are very familiar with. And then why do we even mitigate and why is it required? I'll cover those topics, and then Chuck will really tackle kind of the bulk of this here, which is really the site evaluation, construction methods, and the monitoring for sustainability. If the purpose of this document was really to provide you a hands-on document to help you improve mitigation success, and we'll try to stress that as we go through today, and then I'll come back and talk a little bit about issues related to mitigation wetlands. So if we go to slide number seven, give you a little bit of background about why ITRC formed a team to deal with mitigation wetlands. Well, wetlands are one of those kind of Rodney Dangerfield ecosystems. They never got much respect for many, many years. But people really started to say, hey, you know, these things are really important. They provide a lot of functions in, you know, obviously habitat for species. Very important in flood control. I mean, we're hearing a lot about the impact of losing wetlands on New Orleans after the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Again, they're also very important in controlling water quality, improving water quality, and have been referred to as, you know, nature's kidneys. Well, despite the fact that they did all these important things, there was a large loss of wetlands. It's been estimated we've lost over 100 million acres. About 50% of the original pre-settlement wetlands in this country are gone. And if we go to slide number eight, you'll see kind of a graphical depiction of that. At the top is essentially what wetlands, how many wetlands we had, again, back in the late 18th century. And then if you go to the bottom, that's what we had about 1980. And white is 1 to 5%. So, again, there's lots of colors here, but the takeaway message is all of a sudden, most of the wetlands in the central and middle part of the country were just wiped out. And that's primarily due to drainage for agriculture. And for those of you who might work with wildlife, particularly those creatures that fly, you know, we know the importance of the Mississippi flyway for waterfowl. I hear that in my department all the time from the ducks people. And you can see that essentially most of those wetlands along that flyway are gone. So let's go to slide number 9. As a result, people start to say, well, really, you need to do something to replace some of these wetland functions that were lost. Well, laws were passed, and we'll talk a little bit about the history of that this afternoon. And people started to try to replace and mitigate for the wetland impacts that they were causing. Well, that was a great idea, but the success rate was abysmal. We only had about 30 to 50% of those projects were successful. And so if you go to slide number 10, that's the reason we formed this ITRC team. And again, as I mentioned, we're trying to develop this hands-on document to help you in the design, construction, maintenance, and monitoring of your mitigation wetlands so that we can improve the overall success rate. Let's go to slide number 11. And again, this is more of an introductory slide, again, just to get you thinking, and we'll talk more about this as we go through today. And again, more information in the guidance document. But the focus of our document really is what's often referred to as compensatory mitigation. And this is, you have a project, you are going to impact a wetland. You are going to drain it, you are going to fill it, disturb it in some way, you get a permit for that, you now have to compensate for that wetland impact. These are tied either to federal or state statutes or both. And what they require is that you reestablish some certain sense of wetland functions. And the amount of that mitigation is a function of your permit and type of mitigation that you do. One of the early decisions we made as a team was that we weren't going to argue about how much mitigation was the right amount, because we'd still be there arguing about that. We had other things to argue about. But we'll talk a little bit about ratios as we get further into the presentation. Again, just kind of an overview slide here. Let's go to slide number 12 and talk about what is a wetland. Well, wetlands are wet, you know, and again, it's essentially, you know, water is at, near, or above the surface for a portion of the year. As I mentioned, again, very productive ecosystems. You find them throughout the world. The specific flora and fauna that are in each wetland are obviously a function of the location, its climate, its geology, the movement and the abundance of water in that particular site. Again, they're very complex and they provide a wide variety of functions. And these are just some of the functions that are provided by wetlands. Let's go to slide number 13. Talk about wetland characteristics. What makes a wetland? And for those of you who do delineation, you know there's those three basic topics. One is the hydrology. And some of you who might remember the Bush-Clinton campaign, that slogan was, it was the economy, stupid, and the wetland mitigation field, you might want to say it's just the hydrology, stupid, because that's really what determines whether or not you're going to have a wetland. Complex interaction of groundwater and surface water, and the fact that you have those flooded conditions leads to the development of specific types of soils called hydric soils. And it's a function of having that loss of oxygen for portions of the year. And once you have the water and the soils, then you get a particular type of vegetation, the wetland species, that will be indicative of that specific wetland. Well, let's go to slide 14, talk a little bit more about each of these. And again, I realize we're just kind of touching the surface here, but more information in the guidance document, and Chuck will talk some about some of these elements as well when you get into planning and construction. As I mentioned, the hydrology is the key element, and it's the single most important factor. If you don't have the water, you don't have a wetland. And one of the things that you need to do when you're thinking about a wetland mitigation project is have a good hydrologic budget, kind of a water balance for your site. And again, on the right in that box kind of gives you all the inputs and outputs that are required to do a good water budget. Let's go to slide number 15. Again, if you have the water, you have that saturation, you have the development of hydric soils. Now, these can be mineral or organic, saturated for part of the years, or totally flooded, and it it's that flooding and that wet state that allows the anaerobic conditions to develop. And again, for those of you who do this delineation, you look for that modeling and those changes in soil color, which are primarily driven by the change in iron and manganese oxidation states. Slide number 16. Again, maybe one of the easiest, and not easiest, but one of the most obvious ways that you know you're in a wetland is by the plants that are growing there. And again, these plants are adapted to grow in those wet conditions, and they can range from kind of unusual and unique plants like the sundew in the top picture to the more lowly and common cattail in the bottom. And as you heard in the introduction, I do a lot of work with constructed treatment wetlands, so we see a lot of these cattails and are pretty happy when they're growing in our wetlands. And I know Chuck, the ecologist, he doesn't give this plant much respect. But again, they provide a lot of important functions in the wetland, and they are the key thing, that one of the things you all monitor to make sure you have the right vegetation mix and the right functional characteristics of your wetland once you build a mitigation wetland. Let's go to slide number 17. One of the first things you have to do if you're going to impact a wetland is figure out what kind of wetland am I impacting, and then what kind of wetland am I going to build to replace that function that I'm losing. And there's a variety of classification systems that are used. The common one is the Cowardin system. Those of us in the Midwest, I mean, you know, we're kind of behind things. We move more slowly here in the Midwest. So a lot of us are still using the Fish and Wildlife Service Circular 39. And Chuck always gives me a hard time about this. But, you know, we're not on the coast. Things don't move as fast here. But again, a variety of systems, and some of these are described in a little more detail in the guidance document. Let's go to slide 18. Again, just kind of a reiteration of some of the important functions of wetland. Again, groundwater recharge, discharge, you know, flood flow, again, habitat, water quality aspects, and also recreation and scientific value. The slide there shows a picture of one of the pattern peatlands in northern Minnesota, very unique for its landforms and vegetation, and actually has been set aside by our state as a scientific and natural area because of its unique characteristics. Let's go to slide number 19. Again, you want to do a functional evaluation of your wetland. What functions does this particular wetland serve in that position in the landscape? And the purpose of doing wetland mitigation is not just to get, you know, 5 acres of wetland for 5 acres of wetland impacted. It's really you want to replace the function. Was that wetland providing flood flow? Was it providing habitat? Was it providing recreation? What is its function? And so a functional evaluation of the impacted wetland is required so you can identify those. And again, lots of different techniques are available in the literature. A common one is the wetland evaluation technique. Let's go to slide number 20. Well, why do we mitigate? Well, the regulators made me do it. And in essence, that's true. And it really started back in 1977 with the Clean Water Act. Now, this is probably better known or most widely known for the fact that it established the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, or what we always call the NPDES program, where you actually had to start monitoring, you know, the point source discharges and leading to the control of those discharges to improve the overall water quality in our country. But when you start putting things into water, you put sand and, you know, silt into water, that's like filling a wetland. And so underneath this program then established that if you were going to place materials in the waters of the United States, you had to mitigate for that. We go to slide number 21. What are the regulatory agencies involved? Well, as part of the Clean Water Act, it said you had to mitigate it, and it was under the Section 404 program, which is run by the Army Corps of Engineers. And they really are essentially the 400-pound gorilla, or maybe on this slide, the 400-ton Tyrannosaurus Rex of the regulatory arena here. They really drive the program. They consult with EPA, Fish and Wildlife Service, and other federal agencies, but they're really the ones who kind of run the program. Now, state and local units of government have their own wetland rules. I think the last time I looked, there's about 14 states that have their own wetland conservation acts. Minnesota's was passed in 1992. And two states have actually assumed the Section 404 program. So New Jersey and Michigan actually run, essentially, the 404 program. I mean, they get feedback. They work very closely with the Corps, but they have assumed it. And for those of you who are familiar with the NPDES program, I mean, almost all states have authority for that. And the reason there's such a big discrepancy between how many states have assumed the NPDES program and how many have assumed the 404 is related to money. When you assume the 404 program, you don't get any money from the Corps to run it. And so the state has to make a sizable commitment to take on this responsibility. And given tight budgets for most states, that's not something that I think you'll see much of in the future. Certainly not here in Minnesota. It's not even on the table. Let's go to slide number 22 and talk a little bit about the guidelines for mitigation and a mitigation sequence. We're talking primarily about compensation or compensatory mitigation, which is really the last option. So the first thing you want to do, if you have a project and a wetland's involved, you want to see if you can avoid it. I work with the mining industry here in Minnesota. Northern Minnesota still contains about 80% of its pre-settlement wetlands. And for any of those of you who visited Northern Minnesota, know that you can't step out of your car without getting your foot wet because there are so many wetlands. So mining companies disturb lots of lands. It's very difficult to avoid it, a wetland, because these are big projects. But often it can be minimized. We worked with one company who was devising a new road to haul material from its mine to its processing plant. They couldn't totally avoid the wetland, but they could minimize the amount. This new project we're working on, it's a big open pit operation. You have to mine where the ore is. Right now, it's about 1,200 acres of wetland are going to be impacted by that operation. And we're working again to see if we can design some of it to minimize it. But again, when you're cutting off the watershed, you're essentially wrecking the wetland. So then if you can't do any, if you can't avoid, you can't minimize, or you've minimized to the extent you possibly can, then you have to compensate, essentially replace those lost wetland functions. And that's what our guidance document focuses on. So let's go to slide number 23. Again, just to reiterate the problem, despite all these regulations, our success rate was only 30 to 50%. So, as a result of that, on slide number 24, the National Research Council did a report looking at wetlands mitigation in the programs. And they published this in a book called Compensating for Wetland Losses under the Clean Water Act. It was published in 2001. They were very critical of the compensatory mitigation program. And again, when you only have a 30 to 50% success rate, you know, that's not even very good for government work. So it was pretty poor. And what they identified some areas that there were really clear problems. One were permit conditions. Some were unclear. Not that I'm sure none of you ever had an unclear permit condition, but some are unenforceable as well, which for a regulator, that's really a bad permit. There was poor tracking of the permits and often insufficient data. And again, it was clear that just replacing acres does not equal replacing functions. Let's go to slide number 25 and talk about, well, why has there been so much failure? And again, this was also identified in that report. The first one was that mitigation was never done. And that seems really hard to believe, but you know, when we started talking about this both as a team and with my regulator friends here, some of these projects are relatively small. If you're a land developer, you submit a permit, and, you know, maybe you've got a small wetland you're supposed to build, and, well, you know, well, I could squeeze in another house in there, and, well, so the mitigation doesn't get done, or maybe not the full mitigation gets done. Again, it's very difficult to continue to monitor these permits because you get a permit application, you issue that, and then you really have to track that. And more permits are always coming in the door, so it's very hard to keep track of all those permits. And so sometimes mitigation doesn't get done and gets missed. Improper hydrology, that's probably like the main problem. And again, as I mentioned, that hydrology is the key. If you don't have the right hydrology, you're not going to get the type of wetland that you want. Sometimes sites are not built according to the plans. I mean, again, we stress this not only in this class, but in the constructive treatment wetland class. You really, no matter how good your contractor is, you need someone on site to supervise them. Because again, sometimes there's, you know, sometimes people are cutting corners, but a lot of times it's just inadvertent. You know, they don't quite understand the plans, or they really want to do this right. And that sometimes leads to the next bullet there, the compacted soils. You've got a conscientious dozer operator. They're going to get this site level because it said, I want this at elevation 1420. And as Chuck will talk about, you know, microtopography is really important in wetlands. You don't need it perfectly flat, but if you don't have someone telling the dozer operator, don't keep driving over that and compacting it because you're going to wreck this media for my plants. And then invasive species, again, those are a real problem, and particularly a problem in some of the long term when you really need to extend your monitoring program out to make sure things like this nice purple loosestrife don't get established in your wetland. We did some work with this plant because we were moving some soil that might have been contaminated, and I learned that a fully mature purple loosestrife plant produces 1 million seeds. So, again, it doesn't take very many of those to start really taking over most of your wetland. Slide number 26, again, other continuing on all the reasons these things don't work, grazing by wildlife, you know, deer, rodents, geese, depending on what you're planting. We were doing an upland restoration near a pond area, and we had these nice Canadian geese frequent our site, and they basically cleared 10 acres of all our cover crop, despite our best attempts to try to keep them out of there. Lack of clear performance standards, again, some of the problems with the permitting. Lack of maintenance, you know, the wrong kind of soils, and not really understanding the ecological requirements for those functions you're trying to replace. So slide number 27. Some of the things that, again, kind of summarizing some of the things from the National Research Council, things that affected success, you know, obviously hydrology is important, as you know, I don't want to belabor that, but I can't emphasize it too strongly. And what they found, though, is that the smaller wetlands were generally more successful, and some wetlands were very difficult, and the success rate was lower. And those were things like riverine and slope wetlands that were more difficult than depressional wetlands, particularly the freshwater wetland where you can actually excavate into the groundwater and establish your hydrology. Where you were establishing this wetland, types of plants, you know, herbaceous wetlands are more easy to establish than forested wetlands. And then time. And the longer time you have to establish this and monitor it and sustain it, the more likely it will be successful. Let's go to slide 28. And as a result of this report, there was a National Wetlands Mitigation Action Plan that was formulated. This was a multi-agency initiative that, again, the Corps of Engineers being the main regulator, having the most authority, was the lead. Again, similar to our document, they wanted to improve wetlands mitigation and really truly achieve a no net loss of wetland function. And so 17 action items were developed. These were listed in a regulatory guidance letter and led to the formation of interagency teams. So there's teams addressing each of these 17 items. Let's go to slide number 29, which just kind of summarizes some of the main issues that were put out in the regulatory guidance letter. And essentially, well, let's implement these National Research Council guidelines. We really want to look at this wetland mitigation in maybe a little more broader perspective and actually look at the whole watershed. So consider the entire system. How does that wetland function in the watershed, and how can we best mitigate that to protect the overall aquatic resource? As part of that, then, again, doing good functional assessments, incorporating stream mitigation and buffers, again, buffers are particularly important. Some of you may have seen, you know, again, hate to pick on the land developers, but these are some of the examples I've seen where you have a small pond or wetland area with no buffer and you have lawns right up to it. It's very difficult to get, you know, healthy wetlands when you have no buffer. And again, this is an issue that we'll talk about at the end too, because it is of concern. How do you get these? And for the developers, reasonably so, how do you get credit for that? Because if you're a land developer, you know, I have to give up 6 lots to put in a buffer and you're not giving me any credit for that. And again, having good mitigation plans are really critical and will be addressed. Okay, let's turn to slide number 30 and talk a little bit about the types of wetland mitigations that one can do. The first one is restoration, returning an impacted wetland to its pre-disturbance state. The advantage is that the wetland hydrology is there or was there at one time. And a classic example for those of us here in the upper Midwest, where, you know, we used to sell swampland to people like they did in Florida back in the 50s and 60s. But the purpose here wasn't to retire, it was to drain the wetland and to farm it and to become a rich farmer. Well, when you only have, you know, 100-day growing season in northern Minnesota, it's hard to make it rich as a farmer. And so we have lots of wetlands that have been drained. And one way to restore those is essentially to plug the ditches, allow the natural hydrology to reestablish. And kind of the thing we always say, well, if you flood it, they will come. And that's pretty true because you have the soils, you have the hydrology, you can bring in vegetation and reestablish that wetland. So the other thing you might consider is enhancing a wetland. You might improve a degraded wetland. Maybe there was fill placed in a wetland. Again, you have hydrology, you can take that fill out. You have an invasive species, you can go in and control that invasive species. Now in the first case, in restoration, you gain acres and you gain function. In enhancement, you gain, you still have the same number of acres of wetland, but you improve the function of that particular wetland. And the last one then is creation or establishment. And that's really what a lot of people have been doing, and that's creating a wetland in a position on the landscape not typically characterized as wetland, or essentially an upland. And it's difficult because you don't have the wetland hydrology there initially. And so you have to create the hydrology. You have to make sure your water budget is sufficient to support a wetland in that location. Let's go to slide number 31. Other types of mitigation. Again, mitigation banking is one option. And again, it's somewhat controversial, and we'll talk about that a little more later. Here, someone has created a large wetland. An example here in Minnesota, we had a mining company who bought an old wild rice farm. It was in a wetland. They had drained it. They reestablished the hydrology, created several hundred acres of wetland credit. For their particular impact, they only needed 100, so they had 100 extra acres. And some of the other mining companies now are purchasing those wetland mitigation credits from the first company for their wetland impacts. In lieu fee program, some states have this. This is, might be called a pay-as-you-go program. One of our counties in Minnesota was doing this for a while. Initially, when our law first got started, they would charge you a certain cost per square foot of wetland that you impacted. That money would then go into other programs that would reestablish wetland functions that the county would run. Preservation is also an option in some areas. There's a very high-quality wetland maybe that is threatened by development. Maybe this is very unique or serves a very important function in the watershed. Some states and sometimes in certain situations you can go out and buy that and preserve it in place of the wetland that you've impacted. Again, you're not replacing the functions. It results in a net loss of function in acres, but you may have saved something very desirable. And then again, we talked a little about the importance of wetland buffers, and regulators are looking at those and trying to come up with ways that, you know, you can get some credit for those, and that it's very important that they be incorporated during your design phase. Let's talk on slide number 32, some other considerations for mitigation, and these were an endless source of interesting discussion in our team meetings. On-site versus off-site. Now, on-site is primarily what has been typically preferred. That's where you're doing the mitigation essentially on the property you own, adjacent or contiguous with the wetland that's being impacted. Again, you want to maintain that function in that particular location. Off-site, someplace other than that. And these site locations can range. They can be in the same watershed. Again, remember the National Research Council suggested we look at these things on a watershed basis, so try to preserve the functions that are occurring in that watershed, or they can be an entirely different watershed. Again, here in Minnesota, there's some interest really in establishing wetlands in places where we've lost most of them. Northern Minnesota, as I mentioned, we have more than 80% pre-settlement down in our farming communities. We have very little of our natural wetlands left. So again, there's some advantages maybe again to establish wetlands in a different watershed. That also leads to in-kind versus out-of-kind. In-kind, you know, you disturb a scrub shrub, you replace it with a scrub shrub. So originally it was on-site, in-kind was the most desirable. Out-of-kind, different physical and functional type. You know, it could be on the same site or it could be removed. And the example I use, you know, really relates to the people in our department who manage the wildlife. And they really would like to get some of those scrub shrub wetlands credits developed as prairie potholes along the Mississippi Flyway. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Chuck, and he's going to talk about some of the some more details about the National Research Council on slide number 33.
Thank you, Paul. Before I move into running through some of the resolutions that the NRC came up with, I do want to make sure everyone understands that the intention of the training that we're going through is just to discuss general mitigation requirements, a general understanding of the framework for mitigation from a regulatory standpoint, as well as some of the technical issues that we'll get into later on in the presentation. We recognize that many of the states have their own requirements related to what they require for wetlands mitigation and such, and this is not intended to discount that, but instead, again, to present an overview of the mitigation process so we can kind of set the stage for everyone to move into more common discussions with their own individual regulators. Now, one of the things here on 33 that we're going to start, slide 33, we'll start talking about is that the NRC, in their discussions about wetlands mitigation, is that they came up with 10, what they felt were 10 operational guidelines for creating or restoring wetlands that are ecologically self-sustaining. So these basically are 10 rules that they felt that somebody who addresses, who does a wetlands mitigation project, if these 10 guidelines are considered, then your opportunity or your potential for having an ecologically self-sustaining wetlands and the ability to meet the performance standards for your wetlands were greatly enhanced. As a practitioner in wetlands management for a large number of years now, I will have to say that there are some things I don't particularly agree with them on, but again, what they do say in general provides a great deal of benefit to people, you know, in terms of designing their wetlands. So if we go to slide number 34, it mentions guideline number one. First off, consider the hydrogeomorphic and ecological landscape and climate. And the idea here is that we do not want to generate wetland hybrids. You're looking at, if your goal is to build a forested wetland, then that's what you want to build. And you want to build something that's going to be fairly duplicative of other wetlands that are in the area. That's why in looking at potential wetland mitigation projects, it's generally wise to look at some type of reference wetland that may be in your area as far as you know, deciding how what you're going to be designing and building. Another issue here is location of the mitigation site. It needs to be in a comparable landscape position and hydrogeomorphic class. This is particularly true if you're looking at creating a wetland. If you are restoring a wetland or enhancing a wetland, maybe it's not quite as critical because you're putting the wetland that you know have been focused on back together. But if you're building a wetland, then that's something you certainly need to be aware of. Consider cumulative impact analysis and ensuring that your mitigation plan describes response to a variety of natural disturbances, including floods, droughts, and storms. One thing here, and a good example, is that I've been working on a stream bank restoration and wetland project up in the state of Massachusetts for a number of years, where we've been going through and we've done all our plantings and we're in the process of monitoring now. Well, this particular river stretch just had its 50-year flood go through this past weekend, so we have had an item in place where we're going to be examining these wetlands out of sequence in terms of the timing for monitoring to see what kind of damage was actually done by the storm and the flood, and then make steps to restore accordingly. We move to our next slide, slide number 35. Guideline number 2 is to adopt a dynamic landscape perspective. We need to consider what is the current and future watershed hydrology when we plan our wetland. Try to consider the current and future wetland location, looking at adjacent and planned land use. As Paul was saying, if you have a small wetland and you're building a development all around it, it really significantly will affect the amount of water that runs off from that development area into the wetland. So it certainly is something that has to be considered. And to that effect, we would want to select resistant mitigation sites, that is, sites that have large buffer zones or sites that are connected to other wetlands that provide corridors of connectivity and dynamics, both hydrologically as well as between the plants and animals that may be developing in these particular areas, and designing a system that uses natural processes. Moving to slide number 36. Guideline number 3 is to restore or develop naturally variable hydrologic conditions. We want to have something where we do have fluctuations in water flow and level. We're not going to want to have something where everything is continually static, because wetlands do not behave like that. There are fluctuations, and we need to, in our design, take into account that potential, which means we need to understand what the duration and frequency of change is in that particular hydrologic regime. We also need to ensure that our wetland represents other comparable wetlands in the same landscape setting, and that we, as I just mentioned, that hydrology should be inspected during flood events. Quite often, if possible, we would like to try to develop a detailed hydrologic study of the site before we actually do our design. And I freely recognize this is not always possible, but certainly something that, if need be, we try to get done beforehand. Moving to slide number 37, choose wetland restoration over creation. It's so much easier to select a site and create wetlands where one previously existed or still exists, as opposed to trying to restore a wetland, create a wetland in an area where you're talking about unknown hydrology or very upland conditions. Moving to slide number 38, avoid guideline number 5, avoid over-engineered structures in the wetlands design. Again, we're trying to build something that's very natural in its setup, something that's passive and it does not require a great deal of maintenance, something that's self-sustaining. So to that event, we do not want to include hydraulic control structures, dikes and weirs and other things that are susceptible to failure in order to ensure that the hydrology of our wetland is sustainable. Additionally, the NRC recommends the use of natural recruitment sources for vegetation and using native seed plants and planting mature plants only as a supplemental. This is one point where quite often the managing regulators will not necessarily agree with this, and you will end up having to do plantings in the hope that the natural recruitment primarily supplements what you are putting out. But that is, this is something that the NRC does recommend. Moving to our next slide, slide number 39, pay particular attention to appropriate planting elevation, depth, soil types, as well as seasonal timing. There are a variety of details that have to be addressed when you're trying to plant plants, put them in the ground, and ensure that they are surviving for any length of time. We have to have an understanding of how close we're putting the plants, how tall they are, how deep we're planting them. All these particular characteristics are very important. And in that, again, we come back to a reference area where we might be able to decide in advance what our wetland is going to be by looking at this particular type of water body which might be in the area. One other thing to consider is that because this is a passive wetland and something that we're looking to develop on its own over the length of time, supplemental watering is not something we want to plan for. Now, it's a possibility that we will do it in initial planting and certainly in drought conditions as we allow the wetland to develop, but past a certain time frame, we do not want to be watering as that does kind of ruin the whole thought of self-sustaining. Moving to slide number 40 now, guideline number 7. In this instance, we want to provide appropriate heterogeneous topography. As Paul touched on, when you develop and design a wetland, and when you build that wetland, we do not want something that is perfectly flat and that is very homogeneous as far as its elevations. We do want to have topographic variations in a wetland. It allows for specific hydro periods and a variation in the type of plants that may be growing. Now, that doesn't mean that we design things with gross order of magnitude changes in elevations. In this instance, what I usually think of is in terms of anywhere in a distance or difference of 6 inches over a common elevation, plus or minus. So we're not talking about something great, but certainly something that does plan and does allow for variations to occur in our system. And along those lines, that also means that we need to be aware of local variations in tidal systems if we're trying to develop something that's more tidally influenced. Moving to slide number 41, which is guideline number 8, the NRC recommends paying attention to subsurface conditions. That is, understanding what soil and sediment geochemistry we have, quality and quantity of groundwater at depth. Not just being concerned with what's in that top biologically active area, but actually getting down below ground surface concerns and issues. Slide number 42, the NRC's guideline number 9, consider complications. Okay, what they're simply referring to there is that we want to plan for the unexpected. We try not to build create or restore wetlands in areas where the sites and the area is particularly degraded or disturbed, because we may end up requiring a great deal of active management to sustain the wetland. And such disturbances can promote invasive exotic species. We do want a mitigation project where we're able to reintroduce the natural hydrology with a minimal amount of work and excavation. The final NRC guideline is shown on slide number 43. And here we're talking about monitoring. And monitoring is probably one of the most critical issues aside from some of the early proper design and understanding of your site to be able to affect a self-sustaining wetlands. The NRC does call for developing adaptive management plans, and that you're not only looking at monitoring water level, but you're also looking at monitoring processes, looking at and controlling exotic species, looking at management with the assessment of wetland performance, and document of structure will not provide enough information to make adaptive corrections. What that means is that the NRC feels that if you're trying to design for replacement of wetland functions, it takes more understanding of your wetland and a different type of monitoring approach than just going out and counting stems and looking at aerial coverage. There are other type activities that need to be incorporated to ensure that your wetland is developing into a self-sustaining system. If we move to slide number 44, okay, here we'll start moving into beginning the compensatory mitigation process. Now, again, as Paul touched on, the mitigation process is part of an entire permitting process, which is going to be driven by either Corps of Engineers and or state regulators, or in states such as I work, New Jersey, where the state is the dominant and major regulator you have to deal with in terms of wetlands mitigation. If you go to the Corps of Engineers website, you're able to download checklists for the individual districts as to what they're looking for in terms of their mitigation process. Quite often there are also state guidances, and at the very end of this, and Mary will touch on this later on, there is a list of websites which might be useful to you in trying to identify some of these particular resources. But how much and what type of compensatory mitigation will be determined as part of that overall permit process, and is something that as a team we really did not comment on in the design document that we came up with. Moving to slide number 45, here we have a decision tree which you can find in the document, which kind of outlines the thought process of what you would go through from beginning to end, from when at the point where you're first starting to look at your area to decide if you have to start getting a permit for your wetlands, to the point where you've put it in ground, you've gone through your monitoring and are ready to either decide it's a success or decide it's not a success, and other things have to be done to turn it into a success. This figure is placed here primarily for your edification, and again, if you were referred to the guidance document, you will be able to see this in greater detail. And with that, we're going to move to slide number 46, which is our first question and answer period. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to Mary, who will moderate this particular period.
Thanks, Chuck. We now do have several minutes for questions and answers. Remember, those of you on the phone lines, you'll be given an opportunity in just a few moments to ask your questions verbally. We will ask you to state your name and where you're calling in from, and the instructors will then answer your questions. For those of you on simulcast, you can click on the question mark button on the top of each screen, and that will allow you to type in your question, and then you will hear me verbally read your question, and you will be able to hear the instructor's verbal response. Let's first open it up to our phone line audience. If you have a question for the instructors, please state your name and where you're calling in from, and don't forget to take your phones off mute. Any questions from the phone lines?
I have a question. This is Barbara Beal from the Chase & Companies in New York. Have you guys, are there any core districts right now that are allowing stormwater management basins that are now being developed with aquatic benches and stuff, at least in New York under the new species program, their core districts that are allowing those to be utilized as wetland mitigation?
Paul, I'm not sure if you have some answer to this. There are some states that I am aware of where that is a process that is starting to be considered. New Jersey actually has a process, I guess, an impetus to start trying to move towards taking stormwater detention basins and make them more into a variant of a constructed wetland, something that is offering more wetland processes than just a stormwater basin would. It is something that, you know, we're seeing to some extent. I can't really say if there is a district that is really leading the way on that. I know that there are concerns in talking to some core folks about this, because while you do have the opportunity to, you know, do some mitigation in terms of, you know, creating this area that does serve a function of stormwater flood storage and retention, the problem is ensuring that the mitigation side of it is still maintained and remains successful without having a stormwater event come through to continually feed it. Paul, do you have any other thoughts on that?
No, I know some of the concerns are similar to what you said, Chuck, too. I mean, I think people are certainly discussing the whole idea of trying to use some of these wetlands that are constructed primarily for treatment, whether it be stormwater or municipal wastewater, as a wetland for mitigation credit. And it really is a function of the hydrology. I know that we've had some discussions here with certain projects with stormwater ponds, and again, they haven't been approved, but a lot of the concern is, well, do you have a permanent water pool here, and how big is that bounce of water you get, as Chuck mentioned, when you get that storm flow? Again, if you can design it so that it really spreads out and you minimize that huge change in elevation typical in stormwater ponds, I think that's going to move the ball forward, but I don't think our district here is accepting them right now either.
Okay, we'll go ahead and take a simulcast question, then we'll come back to our phone lines. This is from Marissa Ryan with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection out of Bartow, Florida. And she asks, what can we monitor for that would provide an indication of function development?
That's a good question. And that's a question that I have wrestled with in terms of monitoring programs. Because it's quite often a more costly exercise than going through and just monitoring for the number of plants or cover area or some of the more simplistic views that you have. When you start getting into monitoring for function, you would almost look at doing a functional analysis for that particular wetland each time that you are doing your wetland assessment, which would mean that, you know, if you're looking at something like the HGM method, you have your, you know, some kind of reference or baseline wetlands, and you're making the measurements against that baseline reference wetland or baseline reference mark as to how your wetland is developing. Aside from that, you know, it's a hard call, and I don't mean to waffle on it, but it's something that, again, while the NRC has called for it, they haven't really said much in terms of how you do that, which is why most people, including myself, have remained in the realm of, you know, counting plants and figuring out aerial coverage and you know, measuring water depths and such like that, and using that as a representative equivalent of how your wetland is developing from a functional standpoint.
Hi, I'm Subin Tritta from North Dakota State University. My question is regarding the slide number 27. in which NRC factors affecting success of wetland in terms of size. It says that the smaller wetlands generally would be more successful. My question is, what would be the relative size of typical small and large wetlands we are talking about, and what probable hydrologic regions could we link to that? Thank you.
Do I answer that, Paul?
No, I'm going to turn that one over to you, Chuck.
Relative to size, smaller versus large, I personally think that that is a fairly relative, depending on what part of the country that you are in. Now, I have seen some information in some of the guidance documents that have come out relative to the hydrogeomorphic classification schemes and some of the documents that have been published relative to some of those processes, is that the small and large, you know, is the barrier between one to the other is kind of in the 5 to 10 acre range. Smaller is less than 5 to 10. Greater is more than 5 to 10. However, again, I would say that that really varies per size, per location. A small wetland out in the Midwest where you simply have greater areas, say even an acre in size, that might be very small, whereas in an area such as New Jersey where you're talking about high development pressures and a lot of areas where you've lost the natural landscape, a wetland of an acre in size may be rather large. Could you restate the question about hydrology? I have kind of lost track while I was commenting on the size issue.
Yeah, the second part was when we say smaller wetlands are more successful, do we have some hydrologic reasons or management issues are we talking about? Thank you.
As far as having hydrology, issues with hydrology, I think I understood what the question is related to the size. When, again, it depends on the area. If you have a wetland that is, you know, driven by, say, a groundwater hydrology, going to be, it has the potential to be a little bit more difficult to try to create a wetland, small or large, in relationship just to a groundwater hydrology, whereas probably the smaller wetlands would be easier to deal with in groundwater wetlands, primarily because you're not as totally dependent on this hydrology supporting, you know, a larger area. Whereas if you had a wetlands that was being driven either more by surface, say a riverine type wetland, or a combination of surface and groundwater, you might be able to get away with what might be considered to be a larger wetland complex for mitigation purposes.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and move on to a simulcast question, and this is in reference to guideline number 5, and it's from Josh Wilson with Fussin O'Neill out of Manchester, Connecticut. And it says, under guideline number 5, you discussed avoiding using engineered structures to control hydraulics. What is your experience with utilizing temporary control structures to ensure the establishment of appropriate hydrology, such as standpipes, then after the hydrology has been established, setting a permanent control structure?
From that time, again, that kind of defeats the purpose of, you know, designing a wetland. And the NRC is calling for, you know, not using either temporary or permanent hydraulic control structures. Now, that doesn't mean that if you're in a position and your district allows it and you have a certain site circumstances, where you are, you know, needing to have these particular structures for whatever reason. You know, my personal view is that I try to stay away from those type of structures because I want this wetland to develop on a trajectory such that it's going to be self-sustaining. And if my wetland requires even a temporary structure to become established, then the question would be, well, what happens when you do take the temporary structure away? So my preference, and certainly what the NRC is recommending, is not to include structures such as those.
Okay, here's a question from Daniel Greener with Langdon Engineering and Environmental Services out of Miami Lakes, Florida. And he asks, are there any GIS-based models developed by EPA or the Fish and Wildlife Service or the Army Corps or others that would assist us in locating sites that are good candidates for wetlands mitigation and watershed assessment?
In my experience is that there is not a defined, and I may be wrong on this, but is my experience that there not is not a, you know, a single GIS-based source where you can go to and start trying to identify areas where you can do a wetlands mitigation. I have in the past employed creative identification of sites through a variety of, local reviews of other type GIS-related information that has been developed for other purposes by the Corps and EPA and several state environmental departments, as well as looking at, other things such as tax maps and other sources of information like that. But it is kind of a drawback in that it takes you some fairly strong sleuthing to be able to identify potential mitigation areas. It's not quite as easy as it would be nice to have.
So we do need to move into the second portion of our presentation. We will have another break for questions and answers at the end of the presentation. So if everybody would now move to slide number 47, I will turn it back to Charles Harmon with AMIC Earth and Environmental. Charles?
Thank you, Mary. In the first part of this presentation, the whole idea was to give you some sense of understanding of some of the technical basis for wetlands, because that will relate to going through and designing and mitigating for them, as well as some of the regulatory and administrative requirements that you might have to deal with in terms of mitigations and going through, through the particular design process. What I'm going to be talking about for the next several slides is getting a little bit more into the nuts and bolts of doing a wetlands mitigation project, some of the technical considerations that you may have to employ, and this is going to be very much outside of or off the wetlands mitigation guidance document that we prepared. So if you have further questions or need greater explanation, I would refer you to that document in order to gain that information. So kind of to summarize, the whole mitigation process is going through and deciding first what are you losing? What kind of wetlands are we going to be losing? And then once we know what kind of wetlands are going to be lost, well now, how and where are we going to replace them? Are we going to replace them on-site? Are we looking at off-site? Are we looking within the watershed? Many of those particular questions are going to be answered based on discussions with your regulators, your particular permit writers, and while off-site and within watershed or without watershed are quite often things that from a hypothetical standpoint the regulatory agencies are trying to move into and consider, it's still most of the time you are going to be doing an on-site mitigation process. And the same comes to deciding how you're going to mitigate. Are we going to restore, create, or enhance? A great deal of the time you're going to be looking at restoration, but there are times that creation and enhancement may come up as your preferred alternative. And once we've gone through these particular mental gyrations, then we actually will develop our proposal, our mitigation plan, and then we'll construct the mitigation wetland. And then once we have that in the ground, we'll start monitoring for the success of that mitigation project. If you move now to slide number 48, what we're going to talk about here are what kind of design considerations do we need to take into account. And some of these are really going to be related to those 10 considerations that the NRC asked for or pointed out. But now we want to think a little bit more about them in terms of the detailed planning and specifications needed to go into building this particular wetland. And those considerations, again, are hydrogeomorphic, considering the hydrogeomorphic and ecological landscape, considering a dynamic landscape perspective, restoring or developing natural variable hydrologic conditions, looking at wetland restoration over creation, avoiding over-engineered structures, selecting appropriate planting elevations. Moving to slide number 49, we'll touch on the remainder of the design considerations, which is including considering heterogeneous topography, evaluating appropriate subsurface soil and sediment chemistry and physics, and understanding complications associated with creating a restoration in seriously degraded or disturbed sites. Moving to slide number 50, one of the things to bear in mind as you start thinking in more detail about your wetlands is that the whole key to a design that is going to end or result in a self-sustaining wetlands is that same real estate mantra that we hear, location, location, location. That is one of your critical issues in terms of coming to terms with how your wetland is going to be, and that it's much more difficult to try to build a wetland in an area such as we see on slide 50, as opposed to if you move to slide number 51, looking at a location here where we know that we have some type of defined hydrology which will be able to support the wetland. Moving to slide number 52, okay, we've gone through these considerations. We've looked at on-site versus off-site. We've decided what type of wetland we're going to have, whether it's going to be a creation or a restoration or enhancement. So now we start need to think about our the actual wetland plan, the mitigation plan that we're going to put together. Now, the key elements of a good wetland mitigation plan is as follows, as is listed here. First, we need to a characterization of the baseline conditions of the impacted wetland. We need to emphatically and definitively state the intent and goals of this wetland mitigation project. Characterization of baseline conditions, which of the mitigated wetland site. This is particularly true if you're looking at creating something that's off-site. The first point related to the area where you're going to be maybe filling as part of your permitted action. The second is what are the baseline conditions of the area where you're going to be putting this wetland. The next key is in preparation of an adaptive management plan, looking at a detailed planting plan, a detailed grading plan, description of the soils to be used within the mitigation project, some schedule or construction timetable, as well as maintenance and monitoring of the wetland after it has been built. We move to slide number 53. As I mentioned, one of the things that is very important in deciding upon your or getting through and putting a good wetland mitigation plan together, and you know, just to make sure that we understand the importance of it, I personally think that doing a wetlands mitigation project, the success of it is only as good as the mitigation plan is. If you do not have a good mitigation plan, something that's going to give a full set of details to being able to put this project in the ground, then the success of that is going to be directly proportional to the amount of effort that you put into that. And one of the first things that has to be made is a statement of what the intents or goals are. Okay, that could be as simple as I'm going to create 1 acre of clustering forested deciduous wetlands, and I have certain wetland functions that I intend to fill. I have certain wildlife I intend to attract in certain communities that I hope to establish. But it's something that does have to be stated so that both you and the evaluating regulators are in full agreement as to where this mitigation project is going. If you move to slide number 54, one of the next things that we need to understand is to characterize the baseline conditions of the mitigated wetland site. And this is not only of the mitigated wetland site, but as the next slide we'll talk about, and we'll mention this in a minute, is understanding the impacted site also. But the designer needs to clearly understand the hydrology available at a wetland construction site prior to final site selection. Again, hydrology, one of the most important issues in designing my wetland. If I understand that, then I'm able to put everything else in line to support a wetland. I need to consider the impact of future land development may have on the quality or quantity of water over time. I also need to confirm that if it's a tidal system, that the conveyance of tidal water to and from the site is unrestricted, and I'm not going to lose that, because as soon as you do, then you've lost your tidal wetland. I need to determine the composition of soil at various proposed sites prior to final site selection. And I also need to consider costs in selecting a site. Now, from a regulatory standpoint, cost issues are something that are not always considered in terms of trying to decide how, what, when, and where your mitigation project is going into effect. But as somebody who works for the regulated community, cost is an issue and something that you need to be concerned with when not only you're designing your wetland, but also when you're starting to look at the sites available for the wetland mitigation project. As we move to slide number 55, again, we need to characterize the impacted wetlands. We need to know what is being lost from a soil standpoint, vegetation, hydrology, and wildlife. From a standpoint of, you know, putting that wetland back together, if it's something that you're going to be restoring after the disturbance, say, for example, you have a hazardous waste site that you're working on and you have to excavate out a segment of a wetland to take some contaminated sediment out. After that site is finished, you need to put the wetland back together. But that means you need to understand what kind of soils did you take out, what was the vegetative community before you took it out, or if it's not before it was taken out, what was the vegetative community like before the contamination went in. If you are going to be building something that's in a different location, again, I need to know what is the site that's going to be impacted so that I can design something appropriately in a different location. Moving to slide number 56, site selection and suitability. Again, there are a variety of things that I want to take into account. You know, as I start looking at site selection, where am I going to put these mitigation sites, either on site or in a different location entirely? Issues such as the availability of suitable sites, as I answered the question for the gentleman from Florida, again, it is quite often very difficult to find, in particular, off-site locations for wetlands mitigation, which is actually one of the reasons why you see the development of wetland mitigation banks, is to allow for those type of compensations to occur. Is this site offer some level of constructability? Are the overall costs not excessive? What kind of technical requirements do I need to be able to affect a mitigation? Logistics of moving equipment back and forth. If you identify a mitigation site, but it's 10 miles removed from the nearest road, you may affect more damage just in trying to get equipment to the location than you would the success and benefits of creating this wetland in a particular area. Likelihood of success, ecological sustainability, as well as the practicability for long-term monitoring and maintenance. Moving to slide number 57. Okay, we're ready now for actually putting the components of the mitigation to get planned together. And again, we talked about hydrology, soils, vegetation, and habitat in terms of losing a wetland. Now this is something that we're going to take into account when we put the plan back together, or put the plan together to put the wetlands back together. Moving to slide number 58. We want to identify in our mitigation plan how we're going to be maintaining the appropriate water to have both depth, duration, and flow sufficient to have our wetlands that we're trying to create, restore, or enhance be successful. Now again, as per the NRC requirements, the idea is to try to do this without the benefit of water control structures. So from an engineering construction standpoint, this is something that you may have to be inventive with in terms of maybe going down deep enough to intercept the groundwater, to have sufficient channels to allow water to move in from local water bodies, or to ensure that drainage from the watershed is going into this particular area, so again, you're able to maintain our hydrology. We also need to ensure that the timing of levels is appropriate for the type of plants I need to plant here. And again, we should develop these, or should make these so the mitigation wetlands develops naturally and doesn't really need significant maintenance in terms of its hydrologic composition. Moving to slide number 59, the discussion of the soils. The mitigation plan needs to provide a variety of things related to soils. And again, I would refer you to some of the checklists that the various Corps of Engineer districts have put forth. We'll talk about some of these particular requirements. But we need to put things down like cross-sectional elevations, both existing and final. What are the pre- and post-construction grades that need to be met? Where am I locating stockpiled areas? Erosion and sediment control plans to keep stockpiled areas of soil from moving back into areas that we are excavating or restoring to prevent the advent of undesirable amounts of sediment into our particular area. Are we doing any stratification of soil layers? At one particular wetlands mitigation project I worked on, we actually attempted to build a fairly significant sized bog where we put down some sphagnum moss over a fairly large area. So in that instance, we had to identify, you know, what was our subsoil base, what was the base of topsoil that we used, and then what was the level of bog moss over that, so we had our sufficient stratification, but still plan that such that the area had the proper hydrology and hydrologic regime in comparison to the elevation of the soil. Equipment staging areas. This is particularly important if you have a site that you're working on where you're going to be using a lot of equipment. You want to ensure that soil, grease, oil, and other debris coming from these pieces of equipment do not have the potential to migrate or be washed into this mitigation project that you're developing. Also, if you are using location of borrow areas in the vicinity of the site. Moving to slide number 60. Now we're talking about identifying what type of vegetation we're going to have in our particular area. And this is just the sample, a sample vegetation list of a project that I worked on once. In this instance, we are building a forested wetlands with a distinct shrub layer with some small openings. And in this instance, we're calling for an area that was dominated by red maple. So I've identified what type, how many plants we had, what size, what condition they are, whether they're potted plants or whether they are bare root, and for purposes of understanding a plant, what type of wetland indicator it has. From a standpoint of working and ordering vegetation, it is important to list the botanical name. There have been several instances where I've worked on mitigation sites where a common name was only used in the mitigation plan, sites that, you know, I've observed or such, where the common name was only used, and the landscaper who was providing you the service of bringing plants out brought the wrong plant because he was calling something by a name that you were calling, but you were thinking of a different species. So it's a very important aspect of ordering plants to ensure you include the botanical name. Moving to slide number 61, things to consider as far as your planting design. Timing of planting to achieve maximum survival. One very memorable wetlands mitigation project I was working on, because of design and construction considerations, it took a long time for the actual building of the wetland to take place, which meant that by the time we were ready to plant, it was almost into winter, which meant that we had to, by the statement of the regulatory agencies, go ahead and plant our plants, but we lost a lot of them because it was a particularly severe winter. So timing of planting really is something that you need to consider. What is the proposed benefit of each plant species? How are you going to plant it? Are you going to use mulch? I know the New York District strongly recommends the use of mulch in bare areas to allow for the development of a herbaceous ground cover, as well as preventing a stormwater washout. The caution is just to ensure that you use a certified inert material rather than hay, which may bring in a lot of noxious weeds. And I've seen a number of wetland mitigation sites that have been entirely overrun with timothy, which has been brought in by the use of hay, which then means you have to start using some means of eradicating that particular species to allow the native wetland species to develop. Also, whether you're using potential soil amendments as well as supplemental watering. Okay, moving to slide number 62. Again, one of the things that you need to decide upon, and this could be a question of the type of plants, it could be a question of cost. Do we want to use bare roots or prepackaged bare root plants? Moving to, or do we want to use potted plants? You'll see all of those varieties. Moving to slide number 63, you'll see here some discussions on how plants should be installed. I don't think I need to go through this because you can certainly see this, but it is a stepwise procedure of making sure that your hole is sufficient size to support the plant, and then place it and water it and put it in such a manner that, you know, it's able to survive. Slide number 64. Again, a little bit more discussion. The slide before, we were looking at something that was a little bit more bald burlap. Here we're talking about potted plants. But again, the same concept of being able to look at your plant, have a sufficient size hole, place it in the ground, and ensure that you're able to put enough soil to ensure that it survives. Slide number 65. Here we have bare roots. a bare root plant. Again, you can see the steps of ensuring that we have sufficient insulation procedures done to be able to make sure that the plant survives. Okay, moving to slide number 66, habitat. As we go through and decide, as we go through and design our wetlands mitigation project, we are quite often focused solely on the vegetation, the soil, and the hydrologic aspects of a wetland, because those are the standard parameters you look at with relationship to a wetlands. But quite often, if you are looking to gain additional benefit, or if your wetlands is actually being designed to support a type of wildlife, you may want to consider additional enhancement activities to an additional wetland or additional wildlife into your mitigation wetlands. That could be, you know, such minor things as using woody debris, logs, stumps, and brush piles. If you're doing a creation project, you clear all the woody debris. Well, keep some of it. Don't chip it all, and stage it in certain areas to allow for wildlife to use it. Creating upland islands within your mitigation project, or the use of open water features, nest boxes. If you have some activity that's more in a stream, you may want to look at things such as wing deflectors, clusters and rock weirs, and other type of aquatic habitat structures that will enable you to increase the amount of aquatic habitat that your wetland may be offering to various types of aquatic species. And additionally, the use of vegetative buffers around your wetland. One thing just to note here, that ITRC has established an ecological land reuse team whose purpose is to look at this very subject. And it is expected that there will be internet training for that particular program and a guidance document coming out probably sometime in the near future, maybe in 2006. Moving to the next slide. Actually, we'll move on to the next slide after that. Slide number 68. This is an example of a wildlife attractor. The use of snags, dead trees that are simply allowed to remain, or you can actually move them from an area into your wetland to allow woodpeckers and owls and other wildlife species such as that to have perching and nesting areas. In areas where they're more tidal, these are excellent places to set up osprey nests and other places where you can have water birds coming in. Moving to slide number 69. One of the issues that has to be considered in terms of the success of a wetlands mitigation project is considering adaptive management. You have to have an understanding that there are going to be a variety of factors that could be influencing the success of your wetland, and your wetlands mitigation plan has to compensate for that, or at least have measures in place that can be used to compensate for that. Certainly here in the Northeast, the presence of white-tailed deer can be ruinous to a wetland. A wetland mitigation project is essentially a salad that's set up for these particular browsers to come in and quite often eradicate species that you've planted, so you have to take steps to compensate for that. You can certainly see from the photo on the right-hand side what a deer can do to plants that are installed in a mitigation project, but it's something that has to be considered. If you move to slide number 70, Paul already mentioned this, and this is the fact that the Canada goose is almost as disruptive as white-tailed deer are. They can be highly consuming in terms of the amount of vegetation that that they take up. If you move to slide number 71, here are Here's a photograph of a Canada goose prohibitor structure in place to keep geese from moving into a wetland area that is has just been extended. So this is something that you may have to consider. In the south, there have been reports of animals such as nutria getting into banks, into areas where you have problems and have the potential to damage these areas and allow for changes in the hydrology of areas that you're trying to trying to develop. If you move to slide number 72, adaptive management is not only for natural resources that have the potential to destroy wetlands, but also to those unnatural resources, mankind, who has the ability to get into areas that have the potential for, in this case, off-road areas where they can drive trucks and four wheels and such like that. So you may be in position as part of your adaptive management plan where you have to look at control features to be able to prevent these type of activities from occurring in an area where you're trying to allow your to develop.
Alright.
If you move to slide number 73, talk a little bit about performance. Now, again, performance standards are those metrics that will be measured to evaluate whether the mitigation is achieved or is achieving its planned goals. Generally, as I said, these are going to be hydrological or vegetative in nature. There are times that you have faunal resources that may be identified or surveyed as a means of determining whether the functional capacity of a mitigation project is being met relative to wildlife habitat and support. There are parameters, performance standards, in some areas where you have to go out and examine soil to see if the soil does have the potential to develop hydrogeomorphic, redoxomorphic, I should say, characteristics as a result of being exposed to water over a fairly long period of time. Again, this is not specifically what the NRC requires in terms of the NRC recommends in terms of looking at mitigation in terms of functional development, but in this is certainly in terms of what is commonly used and what is something that the regulatory agencies will generally look at. If you move to slide number 74, again, further issues related to how monitoring is going to be made over a period of time, such things as examining surface water, groundwater elevations, elevations of a wetland floor at critical points, physical integrity of inlet or outlet structures, not really recommended to use, but if they are used, certainly you have to include those in the monitoring program. The community composition and coverage of your vegetative community, plant health and success, as well as the presence of nuisance species, wildlife species presence, quite often water quality measurements could be asked for, erosion of buffer zones, and as we saw back in the photograph, the evidence of human disturbance all have to be monitored for and addressed. Moving to slide number 75 to mention just a little bit about reporting procedures. Quite often in your mitigation process or your monitoring process, you are going to have to come up with some means of reporting the results of how your monitoring and your wetlands mitigation is doing to the appropriate permit riders or regulatory agencies, which means that you'll have to develop some list of parties who are responsible for the monitoring, who needs to receive this particular report of your findings. And that report should actually include the results of your monitoring activities, some type of qualitative analyses of the data. And probably most important, monitoring photographs, making sure that you include a map that has reference points where those monitoring photographs are taken from, as well as other monitoring areas that you may be examining on some kind of frequency basis, as well as the results of any remedial actions that you took. So if you went out and you have a certain performance standard of meeting some success criteria in plants in terms of survivability, if you did not meet that and you planted X amount of plants to compensate and bring the standard or the number of plants up to the performance standard, you should report that so that the, again, the permit writers know what's going on at your area, as well as any field data sheets that you you identify and use during the process. We move to slide number 76. Just a quick comment on construction. The construction specifications are, again, a very important part of a wetlands mitigation plan. I'm an ecologist, so I can tell somebody who's going to be looking and permitting this particular, approving the plan biologically, ecologically, what I would expect it to do, what I would like it to look at the end. But I need to interface with an engineer who is able to provide some kind of construction specifications so my biological needs are, ecological needs are transformed into something that somebody driving a bulldozer or a backhoe or something else is going to be able to put in the ground and make it look like the wetlands that I would like it to look like. So at a minimum, the construction specification should include responsibilities and contact information for all parties involved, identification of source material for plants, copies of contracts noting landscaper responsibilities such as fertilizer, plant replacement, very important. If you have a landscaper who is doing your plants, he should have some set time frame of what he's responsible for plant replacement. That's particularly important seeing as there are many times that the landscaper responsibility for plant replacement is not as long or near as long as the amount of time that you have to spend actually monitoring and ensuring your plants meet some performance standards. So that's something that you have to identify time so as not to accrue some unwanted cost in terms of plant replacement. Moving to slide number 77, this is just kind of a typical construction checklist that you might pull off of some of the Corps of Engineer checklists, and this is basically information related to the season that you're going to be doing the construction in, schedule, types of equipment, staging areas, spoil disposal, what type of grading controls are you going to have, how are the upland slopes adjacent to the wetland, how are they going to be managed, controlled, and protected, and what kind of quality control efforts are you requiring of the people who are actually doing the construction. So finally, we are ready to, we've gone through the design process, we move to slide number 78. We've gone through and we're ready to actually implement the mitigation plan. We need to put down our soil erosion and sediment control aspects of the process, prepare the grade, plant selection and staging, and then actually putting the plants in the ground. Moving to slide number 79, this kind of refers to the comment I just made about interpreting plans. There are certain things that I need as an ecologist for the operator who's putting this wetland in ground to do. So we need to ensure that, one, the engineering aspects of it are fulfilled so an appropriate plan can be made to put the wetlands in. But we also need to have something where the operator who's running the bulldozer is doing the things necessary to make this wetland a little bit more successful, such as including an understanding of things like microtopography and not overly compacting the soil. Moving to slide number 80, these are just some of the areas and issues that I need to consider with respect to soil erosion and sediment control, and actually the whole reason why we get into it. Moving to slide number 81, site preparation and grading. Set up our soil erosion sediment controls, now we're ready for parasite, whether it be a restoration or a creation, but we need to clear vegetation, remove any of the debris, adjust the topsoil, whether it be bring something out, put something in, grading the subsoil, replacing the substrate, and again ensuring that it is uncompacted. And if we move now to the next couple of slides, and it's taking a long time for my computer to load the next slide, but if you have your slide up, what you're looking at over the next two slides, you know, basically is a demonstration of what microtopography should look like, and that is, in both of these instances, we don't have perfectly flat areas. These are wetland restoration areas where we are ensuring that there is subtle differences in the elevation of the floor of the wetland such that we're able to get a variety of plants and a variety of processes moving in each one of these particular areas. And with that, we can go ahead and move on over to 84. And what we're trying to show here is an English muffin. This is slide number 84. And what we're trying to show here is that we want the floor of the wetland to be like the English muffin. We want it to have all sorts of little nooks and crannies such that we have a lot of different things that grow in our wetland and not necessarily something that's perfectly flat. Okay, moving to slide number 85, I should say. Wetland plants and plant installation. We've already talked a little bit about how we actually put the plants in ground, but one of the things that we are going to be concerned with, one of the things to mention here is plant orientation and spacing. When you're putting your plants in the ground, there are a lot of different ways that you can put plants across the landscape in your mitigation project. The easiest way is to put things on a grid basis. It's easy, it's cheaper, because you're simply able to tell your landscaper, your laborers, that I need to have these particular plants spread. They need to all be exactly 3 feet apart. It's quick. You're able to get your plants staged across the landscape and installed in fairly quick order. That's opposed to something that's more functional from an ecological standpoint, and that is trying to put, again, diversity and heterogeneity in your plant community such that you would place plants, group them in clumps in certain areas, spread them out in others, not use them at all, rely on maybe herbaceous plants in still another area. That type of plant spacing and orientation is ecologically more viable, but because you have to be more cognizant of where the plants are, it takes more time, which again would relate to more money. Probably one of the easiest ways I found to compromise between the two processes is to set things on kind of a modified grid basis. That is, I'll say that we have maybe a 4-foot difference between each plant, but I give the laborers the option at each location to move the plant one way or another 6 inches. And that way you're able to move the plants around. You get a little bit more heterogeneity, but you're still able to move through in a fairly quick basis and trying to get the plants installed. The next few slides to mention relate 86 and 87, talk more about some of the costs that you associate with various types of mitigation wetlands. And cost, is something that is an issue. It is interesting in looking at some of the costs. Plants quite often are going to be one of your major hurdles in terms of trying to identify how much money you put into a mitigation process. Emergent plants by dint are a little bit cheaper than a forested species, a tree or a shrub. However, you have to use a lot more of the herbaceous plants if you're using pots or plugs or something like that, which again can run up the cost. You can kind of look at this at your leisure, both slide number 86 and 87. Again, this is just intended to give you some assessment of what costs can typically be for mitigation projects. The final couple of slides just to go through, and these are something that we have placed in the mitigation document for your use. One of the things that you will have to do as you go through your monitoring is you need to document what you have, what you're seeing in terms of the monitoring program. And this slide and the accompanying slide number 89 are simply a mitigation monitoring form that you can use for purposes of documenting what you see at your mitigation site. And again, it's just a convenient document for your use. And with that, we're going to move to slide number 90, and Paul's going to pick it up here, and he's going to be talking about issues relative to wetlands mitigation.
Thanks, Chuck. Well, I got stuck with the issues section since I still have teenage daughters at home and Chuck got rid of all of his. So, and actually it was a flurry of emails related to some issues with my number three daughter this morning. But luckily those have been resolved, so I'm here to talk to you about some issues that hopefully are a little more fun than dealing with teenage girls. So let's go to slide number 91 and talk about some of these. Obviously, there are regulatory issues involved with the whole wetland mitigation process. And, you know, for those of you who are permittees, you know that part of the problem is that there's multiple permitting authorities. And we've talked about, you know, obviously federal and state, but also some local units of government have some wetland boards, and you have to meet with them and meet their requirements as well. We also talked about the lack of federal or state oversight and follow-up, and again, that's, we're all trying to work to change that and to make that less of a problem and get a better product. The ecological value compared to the impacted wetland. Again, this is a whole idea related to the idea of functional replacement. You know, the wetlands that were impacted have been there for hundreds or thousands of years, and, you know, I'm an engineer and we think we can do everything, but we're not going to be able to create a fully functional wetland in 3 years as much as, you know, we might like to tell you we can. So there's a real concern about, you know, how long does it take to actually start to replace those functions that the wetland is serving. Sustainability is a key. Again, you can build these things, but if you don't maintain them, monitor them, and protect them, they're not going to be there in the long run. And again, that's some of the stuff that Chuck talked about in terms of the adaptive management and having to make sure you've got a good management program, you have some flexibility so that you can sustain your wetland. Replacement ratios and functional equivalency. And again, I think I mentioned earlier that we decided that we're not going to get into this because this is obviously something that people get pretty heated about and can spend lots of time arguing over what the right number is. And, you know, this varies all over. You know, the minimum type of replacement that we've seen is, you know, you impact 1 acre of wetland, you have to replace it. And they can go up to 10, 20 to 1, again, depending on the permitting agency, the specific site, and the conditions that you're dealing with. So So, but again, a very big issue in related to designing mitigation programs and working on your permits. In-kind versus out-of-kind, again, you know, this is a big issue. I think there's becoming more flexibility now in terms of looking at what works best for, say, the entire watershed, and that's coming out of the NRC report, and I know the Corps is looking at that. But again, you know, it's certainly a very hot topic, and lots of interesting discussions arise around this, as well as the on-site versus off-site. And again, we talked a little bit about that in the beginning. Again, the pros and cons of looking at both of those types of approaches. For slide number 92, mitigation banking. Again, some real advantages to this. Again, there's for the applicant and the permittee, there's some economic incentive. You know, you essentially pay your money and you're done. You don't have to worry about monitoring and reporting and adaptive management. Someone's already got the wetland. And it provides, you know, someone's managing this for you, and some regulators also like it. I know some of our folks, as I mentioned, like it, particularly for smaller projects, because you know, they just have one bank to watch as opposed to maybe 20 smaller projects. The other advantage is that this type of mitigation, you've actually got the wetland credit before you have the wetland impact. So you've mitigated for the impact prior to the impact, impact occurring. Disadvantages, it's generally out of kind, and it is usually off-site. So again, have to take that into consideration. Another issue, and that this came up in one of the questions in the first question and answer, is the idea of using constructive treatment wetlands as mitigation credit. And this is certainly an area of active discussion. Some areas I know, particularly in the arid areas, have really defined their constructive treatment wetlands to provide wetland habitat. That's particularly true of wastewater treatment plants where they're using this last stage as a polishing unit. So the water coming in is very good quality. They can easily establish, you know, a nice environment that is safe for wildlife to use. Let's go to slide number 93. And each ITRC team has a public stakeholder. And they're a very important part of the whole ITRC process because they bring another perspective and provide balance for the team. And these are some issues that they have raised, and we've included them as a separate section. I just want to highlight a couple of them. Some of the concerns that the public has expressed is that, again, typically your creation or your mitigation occurs after the wetland has been impacted. So you are suffering this temporary loss of wetland function. And so they're suggesting that really the creation or the mitigation process should occur first, right, before you actually do your project. And in some ways the banking option, as I mentioned, takes that into account. And the other thing is that the public is asking for a longer period of time for monitoring. Typically minimum monitoring periods for permits is 3 years. Sometimes you've seen 3 to 5. But again, you know, the longer you monitor, the longer you watch this, the better you can adapt your management and ensure success. But again, the more you have to monitor, the longer, the higher the cost, the more reports you have to write, the more you have to oversee that. So there's a real balance in how you can try to, and there's been discussion about how you can maybe increase the monitoring time by maybe alternating or maybe not as complete monitoring every year, but still track it. Let's go to slide number 94. The stakeholders are also recommending buffer zones. And again, you know, those of us on the team think this is a great idea and very critical to increasing your mitigation success. I think we talked briefly about some of the problems, about how you give credit for that, the cost to the person who's doing the project. Some states, Minnesota is one, we have some size exclusions. If you're, I think our current exclusion is about 10,000 square feet or about 1/4 of an acre. You know, if that's the amount of wetland you're impacting, you don't need to go through our wetland program, and the stakeholders say, well, we don't want any size exclusions. And again, some states don't have that. And as Chuck mentioned, it's very important that because there are these variations in regulations that you really need to discuss these issues with your regulators. It's important to protect these, and some of the best methods that the stakeholders recommend are deed restrictions and conservation easements, so that once you've created this wetland, it is going to stay a wetland and truly replace that function that you've lost. And a general concern of the public is always that there needs to be better involvement at all stages of the process. So we're going to slide number 95, and just some concluding remarks. And the key thing in all projects is you have a solid foundation, and some of you might recognize this as the politically correct version of the 70s, but it is really important to have a good plan, and that requires good upfront planning, and Chuck stressed the importance of, you know, a good mitigation plan. And I want to point out that there's two very good examples that Chuck provided for the mitigation document, the guidance document, and they're in the document as appendices. So if you want to see good examples of plans, they're in there. And again, I cannot overstress the importance of that. Let's go to slide number 96. Consistent reviews, standards, checklists. Chuck talked about checklists. This is another site for you to get to look at checklists. And then communication. Again, that is so critical in all projects. Again, you've got a variety of state, federal, local regulators. You have different stakeholders. You have the applicant. You really need to bring these people together and emphasize that, you know, we're all in this together and we have a common goal. It's critical for your project that there's some pre-construction meeting. Again, communicating, as Chuck mentioned, the ecological needs to the people that are building your project, and to make sure the applicant and the regulator are all together and understand exactly what's going to be done. You know, I'm a regulator, a bureaucrat. We love meetings, but there are really advantages to having periodic meetings, especially in projects that are large scale where lots of things can go wrong. And again, as Chuck mentioned, you often need some adaptive management and flexibility to make these projects work. And with that, that brings us to the last question and answer period, and I'll turn it over to Mary.
Thanks, Paul. We do, again, have time for questions and answers, but before we do that, I want to take you through slide 97, over to slide 98, and in the center of that slide, it says links to additional resources. Go ahead and click on the text that says links to additional resources, and that will take you to the links page that provides you an opportunity to download the slides for the training today, which do include some additional speaker's notes. And also, you can access the guidance document that served as the basis for this training. You will also see under the ITRC specific link several other guidance documents that are related to this topic. If you scroll down further, there's many, many links listed here, some EPA links, some Army Corps links that could be valuable to you if you're considering mitigation wetlands projects. Also, if you scroll down further, there are several state program links, and these are the ones that Chuck mentioned during his portion of the presentation. This site will remain active, so if you'd like to come back to it at a later date, you're certainly welcome to do so to access this information. If you scroll down all the way to the bottom, there's a direct link to the ITRC website where you can get more information not only about what's going on with the wetlands documents, but also many other projects ITRC has going on at this point. Also, you can access information on some of our upcoming training courses. Let's scroll back now to the top, and under the Clue and Sun on the left-hand side, the third bar down says feedback. Please click on that form and let us know how the training went for you today. Let's go ahead and take some more questions. Let's first start with our phone line audience. Don't forget to take your phones off mute, and we would ask that you please state your name and where you're calling in from. Any questions from the phone lines? Okay, hearing none at this point, and currently we don't have any simulcast questions in the queue either, I'll give you a couple moments to think of some questions if you do have any, and I will announce some upcoming training courses ITRC will be offering. On October 20th, we have a course on strategies for monitoring the performance of DNAPL source zone remedies. On November 3rd, a course on design, installation, and monitoring of alternative landfill covers. On November 8th, a course on radiation site cleanup. On November 10th, a course on the triad approach. And on November 17th, a course that may be of interest to many of you, and that is on constructed treatment wetlands. Registration is open for those courses. If you would like to register, also through the EPA Cruin website, the NIEHS is sponsoring a training on October 26th for DNAPL's enhanced remediation of DNAPL contaminated subsurface systems. So if you're interested in any of those, again, registration is open. Let's do another check-in with our phone lines. Is there a question for the instructors? Okay, we did just have a simulcast question come in, so I'll get to that here momentarily. This is from John Castorinos with Haley Aldridge out of Boston, Massachusetts. And he asks, regarding wetland creation, how do you resolve the apparent conflict between avoiding disturbed sites with the desire to avoid disturbing pristine buffer areas that may serve as a valuable upland habitat? Paul or Chuck, do you want to jump in on that one?
That is an issue and something that is really going to be dependent on, you know, on the sites that you're working at. I'm not sure if I have a clear answer for that other than you want to be able to avoid sites that are going to raise all sorts of difficulties in terms of, you know, potential hydrologic issues, possible reestablishment of invasive species. On the other hand, the wetland buffer area is, in my mind, just as ecologically important as the wetland itself. So trying to, you know, have areas where we have more pristine buffer areas, sometimes I question the placement of a mitigation site in a particular place, just because that may be the case where I'm destroying something to try to create something that's possibly not even going to be that as beneficial as the buffer. So I don't really have any clear guidance, Paul. I don't know if you do. It's just something that has to be kind of taken on a case by case basis.
As I mentioned, I do a lot of work in the northern part of our state. Kind of the joke up there is, well, why, we need an Upland Conservation Act, not a Wetland Conservation Act, because we have some counties that have actually over 90% of the land is actually wetland. And I guess one of the things, you know, it is a difficult problem. One of the ideas of going out of kind off-site provides you maybe some more options to look for better mitigation sites. And again, it's obviously controversial. Even here in our department, we have disagreements over this, but, you know, some people say, well, you know, our state has lost wetlands of all types in all portions of the state, and so if we can find a good mitigation project in another portion of the state that makes good ecological sense, we should support that rather than, you know, trying to disturb a pristine area in closer to the impacted site.
Here's a question from Daniel Greener with Langdon Engineering and Environmental Services out of Florida. It says, many permits require percent cover of herbaceous plants as well as canopy cover. Since canopy covers take longer to establish than most monitoring periods, how do you extrapolate to determine whether permit conditions are being met?
Usually when I establish my performance standards in those kind of instances, I will say that you know, whatever the herbaceous cover is, and then once the canopy starts to develop, I will say that that herbaceous coverage has to be met outside of the drip line of each individual tree species that is growing, noting that you are going to have difficulties maintaining a herbaceous coverage under a developing canopy.
Okay, and he has a second question also. He says, also, are retrofitted wetland detention basins ever considered for mitigation?
I have not seen them used as such.
Okay, let's ask for questions one last time from the phone line audience. Okay, hearing them at this point, we will go ahead and wrap up today's training course. A special thanks to our instructors again for serving as volunteer instructors and team members for the ITRC Mitigation Wetlands Team. And certainly thanks to all our participants for joining us today. Don't forget the upcoming ITRC training courses. Registration is available for those through the website, through the ITRC, as well as the CLUIN website. So thanks, and have a great day, everybody.